Blog Talk Radio.
Saturday,
1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and you're listening to the Ooze with your host, Avenger Satanus, and the Beast.
Thanks for tuning in. I'm T.C. Downey, and this is my co-host, Avenger Satanus. Avenger, how you doing, man?
I'm doing good. How are you doing?
Well, I'm doing okay, considering all things.
Mm-hmm. All things considered, yes.
Today should be quite an interesting show. I don't know how long we could actually stay on the main topic, but we usually tend to manage to do pretty good at that, so I'm not going to focus on it too much.
Do you want to get right to it, or do you want to maybe discuss other news?
Well, we certainly should cover any new news, get that out there first, and then, that way, in case we don't get to our allotted time slot for talking about whatever, at least we've got the news out there for everybody who listens to the show.
Yep.
So, give you the reins, man.
Oh, okay. Apparently, my sources tell me that if you are in Hawaii, then you should probably get the fuck out, because something's going on there. I'm not sure. Is it like a tsunami or something? I don't know if you've heard about that, but
I haven't actually. When did this start?
I think yesterday.
Well, that would explain it. The past 24 hours have kind of been a bit blur for me, so.
I've been working on some new paintings. That's cool. Abstract stuff, which I know some people are a fan of my non-abstract material. But lately I've just been in an abstract kind of mood, so I've been doing that. If you check the forum, then you know that there's an essay that has recently come to light. It's called A Half-Choked Meep of Cosmic Fear. Basically, it covers Lovecraft, the dream quest of Unknown Kadath as it relates to the Golden Dawn system of Aleister Crowley and Mathers and the Tree of Life and the dark side of that, the Klipoth and all that stuff. By the way, I'm getting this ridiculous echo. Right after I talk. I don't know if anyone can hear that, but
it's not coming through on my end, but if it's persistently...
Well, I'll just ignore it. It's not like I can do anything about it. So, anyway, apparently this essay was written a couple years ago, but it's, like I said, it just came to light. This was discovered by me and a couple other cultists recently. And so I have it on order. I'm going to read it as soon as it comes. I'm rereading the Dream Quest of Unknown Kadath right now, which is an awesome lengthy short story or short novella by Lovecraft. And that has huge implications. Basically, it means that Lovecraft knew about, occult systems that he otherwise shouldn't have known about, and that scholars would be very surprised that he had this information. And it leads people to believe that, a couple different things, that Lovecraft was involved with people or knew about organizations that he never told anyone about. You know, things like the Golden Dawn or whatever. Or he was even more in tune with certain currents of magical energy and you know, magical structures and concepts of the day than even myself was aware. So, I don't know. That's a pretty big deal.
I would tend to think that just given the way that everybody who makes some kind of an important contribution sort of intuitively knows there's something there, I would think that someone as introspective as Lovecraft was and as inverted as he was, you know, he would be somebody who would be highly susceptible to if there's some kind of a case of current. So I would think that perhaps that's, you know, a good portion of it. But then there's, you know, another part of it that says that, you know, he was just a big fan of cosmic horror and realized that there were certain elements within it. And perhaps he, you know, spent some time reading books and researching, you know, for different characters and just became familiar with these patterns.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, except that, that from what other Lovecraft scholars know, because of his well-documented life, due to all the letters he wrote, sometimes he would write several 10-page letters about himself and what he was thinking and what he was doing every week. He never mentioned, scholars know exactly what books he read and where they came from and at what time he read them, and what he thought of them at the time, and how much he used in the stories. But this unknown Kadath stuff, that just came out of nowhere. From what scholars know, he didn't have access to certain books that would have helped him write that, and helped him mirror this dark side of the Tree of Life and all that stuff. So it's kind of a puzzle and a mystery.
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, it could be as simple. I don't know. Have you ever seen the movie Jackal, I think was the name of it? It was Richard Gere and Bruce Willis. And there was an autistic child who I guess could see allegory patterns and you know, real high tech secret coding that just kind of unraveled itself in front of them. There are people that exist out there that are like that just can look at a puzzle and they it just makes sense to them.
Yeah. Well, that's a good idea or theory, because Lovecraft was something of a child prodigy, and you know, he was speaking Latin and reading books beyond his years at like 5 years old, kind of the equivalent of Mozart, you know, how good he was with music and the piano and stuff. So yeah, that's entirely possible. You think that maybe he could have, I don't know, extrapolated certain information that he did have access to and sort of figured it out for himself?
Sure, sure.
Just by seeing it? Or?
Yeah, just by seeing it, I think that, you know, he may not have even had a full comprehension of what it was that he was seeing. You know, it may have just seemed like good fodder. You know, it's mysterious enough to him that it's certainly going to pose mystery to us, and so why not insert it? Why not use it?
Right. That's something I would love to know. Like, at what times was Lovecraft serious about what he was writing? And because I'm sure he had a good sense of humor and he had a good, you know, knowledge of the frivolous and humor and wanted to, you know, pepper his stuff with lighthearted in-jokes and things like that. But there are some concepts that he comes back to again and again, which he must have taken very seriously. And I don't know. That's just, you know, that's part of the mystery of Lovecraft. Like, you know,
sure,
how much
sure.
Did he believe, and how much did he want to believe? Anyway, once I've read the essay, we can talk more about that.
Sure, I'm actually. I've been heavily sifting the internet myself for this essay because I would love to get to the nits and gritty of it. And
it's pretty obscure. I don't think there's going to be like a PDF or like an internet version for free. My guess is you'd probably have to buy a copy of whatever it is. I think it's the Journal of Scholarly Magic or number 3. I don't know. You'll have to check the form.
It's
on there.
Right. Well, I'm actually, they're selling it for $40, and I am intending to purchase it probably this next coming weekend.
Did you check Amazon?
Actually, yeah, I believe that's where I got the price $40 from.
Oh, really? Oh, I saw it in there for $30, but
I believe the $30 was the used, and I wanted brand new.
Oh, I see. Well,
I mean, I may be wrong. It's been a couple of days since I've looked at the price of it. I just determined that I wasn't going to be able to, you know, sift out the PDF for it on the internet, so I might as well just get the actual document itself anyway. Plus, on top of that, I'm sorry, on top of that, they look like there were several other really interesting articles that were in that magazine, that particular issue of that magazine. So I deemed it worthy.
Yeah. I think it's definitely a good purchase. It is a few years old, so even a new copy. I don't know how much it's going to be different than a used copy, but either way, that's cool. Yeah, I think you should get it. I finally got that Gurdjieff book, which definitely would have come in handy. And I gotten it prior to last week's show, which was on Gurdjieff.
Right.
And so I'm going to start reading that. It's called Gurdjieff, An Introduction to His Life and Ideas by John Shirley. There's one little quote at the very beginning of this book. I'm just going to read that before we get into the actual topic of today's show, because I just think it's pretty awesome. Okay. There is 1,000 times more value, even in polishing the floor, as it should be done, than in writing 20 books. That's a direct quote from G.I. Gurdjieff.
Right, that actually kind of corresponds with something you and I were talking about earlier this week, and that is that Gurdjieff seemed to really just be at peace or be at the pinnacle of his you know, personal, I don't even know what I want to call it. He just seemed to be at his height when he was actually doing physical work.
Yeah.
He found something very therapeutic in it and something very nurturing.
Yeah.
And so I'd be really interested to see what you get out of that. I'm actually getting ready to get into another book by Gurdjieff. I'm going in order myself, so.
Okay, cool.
Then whatever the second book is, I plan to get that PDF and start tearing that down this next week or so. But let's get back to the actual topic here. People who have made, you know, huge contributions to this world have been the focus of most of these when we're talking about these people. That's the deal. These are the influential people. And according to Michael H. Hart in The Hundred, he ranked our next character, Sir Isaac Newton, as the second most influential person in history, one step below Muhammad and one step above Jesus. So let's take a look at Newton and why that is, I guess. And the gravity of who Newton really was. The first thing when you hit the Wikipedia page that you see is that Newton wasn't just a physicist or a mathematician. Newton was, in fact, he was a physicist, a mathematician. He was an astronomer. He was a natural philosopher. He was an alchemist and a theologian. And I think being above and beyond that, and something that's, I would almost deem it to be speculative. It states at the very bottom of this page that he was highly religious, and they considered him to be an unorthodox Christian. And believe it or not, most of his writing was on biblical hermeneutics, which I'm not even really sure what biblical hermeneutics is. I'm assuming that it's like a biblical study through hermetic philosophy. But
Or it could be trying to come up with like a hidden or magical interpretation of biblical writings.
Sure. Well, this is what this says. It says it's a study of the principles of interpretation concerning the books of the Bible. So I guess in the way that Hermeticism and alchemy, which is a form of Hermeticism, I try to use symbols and allegory to correspond and communicate different concepts and ideas that we can all relate with just by the imagery. I suppose that's what he was really trying to get to. Obviously, Newton's biggest breakthrough as far as modern-day people are concerned is the dude who discovered gravity. He's the guy who said, hey, this apple hits the ground. Every time I drop it, there's got to be something pulling it down.
Mm-hmm.
What's actually really fascinating to me is, he had this theory, and it was, a good, solid theory, but he couldn't explain how it worked other than, cause and effect type deal. If I let go of this apple, it drops and it hits the ground. I suppose that it happens because of these things, but I have nothing that I can use to physically prove it. That's, pretty much, where Newton lied. He was kind of, in a way, ingenious, and in another way, he probably felt like a blabbering moron at the same time, because here's this brilliant man who's come up with this, set of three laws of motion that are, what we've based a lot of our modern science and physics on, and yet at the same time, he couldn't figure out how to explain, why it does what it does. His theory, as I understand it, and I could be wrong, his theory was that everything had a magnetic center, and that pulled objects that were within a certain mass or towards it. Which is why the moon supposedly rotates around the Earth, and the sun rotates around the Earth rotates around the sun, and so forth.
Yeah, it's very interesting that it mentions the magnetic center, because that's a concept that we use in the work.
Oh, certainly. As a matter of fact, that was Newton's big thing. He was a devout alchemist, and it's well documented. Newton believed the as above, so below, that you could take anything of internal science and transpose it on something of external science, and you would have the same same thing happened, the same effect. And so, you know, he studied the stars and all this stuff, but at the same time, he was, you know, racing inward, too, to try to, you know, figure out, you know, what corresponded with what. And he really had a good, solid, from what I can understand, he had a good, solid way of looking at things. And for about 250 years after the discoveries that he made, you know, his science was, you know, it was the core building stone for everything that modern science had become up until that point. You know, and I think it's really fascinating that the one thing that Newton can't figure out, Albert Einstein stumbled into by default. You know, Einstein believed that light was, the speed of light was like the cap. It was the speed limit. It was as fast as things could go. Mm-hmm. But if that was the case, then, you know, what's the deal with gravity? Because gravity would have to move faster than light to have the effect that it had.
Right.
And actually, Einstein then came up with this whole concept of time-space material, or time-space matter. And all of this was how he, you know, actually figured out how gravity works. Because rather than everything immediately pulling to each other, what they've done is they've settled into the fabric of time and space, and the magnetic part of them, you know, put them in the spot that they are, but now they've kind of worn a groove that they're rotating around in. And so that groove is not visible to the eye, but it can be seen in terms of measurement when you're working, you know, on the level of light. It really complicated shit, and I really didn't get into this enough. I really think maybe we ought to start busting these shows down to once a month, or at least starting to study a month ahead of time for our shows, because I don't think I can pack enough information in a week into my brain and process it to be able to, you know, come out and say something really, truly, you know, profound. But on the other hand, you know, maybe just raising the question is good enough.
Maybe.
So,
I did find something very interesting on that basic subject on Wikipedia here. I thought I would just read it because it was a pretty good few sentences. In his Hypothesis of Light of 1675, Newton posited the existence of the ether to transmit forces between particles. The contact with the theosophist Henry Moore revived his interest in alchemy. He replaced the ether with occult forces based on hermetic ideas of attraction and repulsion between particles. John Maynard Keynes, who acquired many of Newton's writings on alchemy, stated that Newton was not the first of the Age of Reason. He was the last of the magicians. Newton's interest in alchemy cannot be isolated from his contributions to science. However, he did apparently abandon his alchemical researches. This was at a time when there was no clear distinction between alchemy and science. Had he not relied on the occult idea of action at a distance across a vacuum, he might not have developed his theory of gravity.
That's interesting.
Yeah, so that's kind of a very cool marriage between science and the occult. And, you know, I think we try to stay attuned or receptive to basically the same thing with, for instance, like chaos magic versus quantum physics and, I don't know, Viridian magic in conjunction with string theory and all sorts of stuff like that.
Sure. I mean, it's certainly apparent that you can't separate the two. You can try to, but you can't. Where science fails to be able to explain, you know, the occult still has an explanation. And that's not to say that science won't one day be able to explain it. But in the meantime, at least we have a sound rationale for why what's happening is happening.
Right.
You know, we have something to appease our mind. I mean, I can't imagine, sitting in a room and feeling tick or flinch that in my arm and not being able to figure out for the life of me what's causing it. I think that would drive me mad, just trying to figure out why my arm's twitching. You know,
right.
On the other hand, you know, if someone came into me and said, "Hey, I know the deal as to what's going on with this. You know, the third star from the sixth sun is got a magnetic pull on you, and that's why your arm's twitching." At least then, you know, there's some external reasoning that I can put to my mind,
right,
to kind of settle the questioning, the inquisition of it, and I can move on to other things and focus myself on other things. Now,
yeah, I think that's why Lovecraft is. That's also one of the things that makes people attracted to him, is because he also, in his writing, tried to marry science with science fiction, and you know, the occult and magic and spiritualism with hard science and materialism and physics and things like that.
Right. Absolutely. I think, you know, once again, I believe that Lovecraft, like Newton, like Einstein, like Crowley, like LaVey, they've all tapped into something, and they all have this understanding of it, even if they don't have a way to explain it.
Mm-hmm.
So I believe that that's just further development on something that we have to, have to really begin to grasp and deal with. As much as people want to consider themselves just to be physical beings, we're both physical and metaphysical beings, and that,
right.
You know, we can't lose the multidimensional part of ourselves. And I'm trying to really think of how I wanted to wrap this up. I was going to make mention that I saw this, or a part of, I haven't finished, but I was watching this little YouTube video, as I'm normally doing, as I'm driving when I have my long trips that I make. It was called The Elegant Universe. I don't know, or the elegant, I'm not really sure which one it was, but I believe it was The Elegant Universe. In that, fuck, I forget what I was saying. Give me a few minutes, I might be able to wrap it back up. My mind is, again, kind of frazzled, so.
It's a documentary on science and the universe and stuff.
Yeah, well,
I've heard of it. I don't know if I've seen it, or maybe I've seen parts of it. I don't know.
Yeah, the thing of it is, that's what it was. In the video itself, it states that all of our physicists, all of our scientists, everybody working in these fields, and I'm going to say the same thing goes in the occult end, too, because the occult, in my opinion, is just a completely unrecognized and unacknowledged science that's really there. all of them all know that all of these things point to there being one thing, there being this one thing. Everything points to there being this one answer.
Mm-hmm.
But they can't quite get close enough. I mean, what Einstein was trying to do was create the unification, and so was Isaac Newton, for that matter. They were trying to create unification. They were trying to show that everything could be worked out in a math formula. that all things could be explained through this math formula. Now, you know, quantum physics came along and fucked up both Newton and Einstein's day as far as, you know, their total theory, their theory of everything goes. But their contributions were still strong enough that I believe that they'll be remembered forever.
Sure. Well, don't you think that that kind of unification or theory of everything or the one answer is a dead end or erroneous? Or do you subscribe to that, that that's actually possible, a real thing to be described for?
B, man, I got to be honest with you. I don't know one way or the other. And I'm
okay.
I'm not going to... What's that?
I said that's fair.
Yeah, well, I can't myself rationally say that I stand on either side of the fence at this point in time.
Mm-hmm.
I believe if there is that one answer, that one thing, it's only erroneous for the matter that we are not advanced enough to comprehend it.
Right.
And so we're going to keep walking around the circle because we don't have enough perceptive abilities. We're not able to perceive enough of dimensional factors. I mean, if you take string theory, for instance, or M theory, you know, they break it down into 11 different dimensions all coexisting with each other. We are only able to actually physically experience 3 plus 1.
That would be 4, right?
That would be 4, yeah, but that they always, for whatever reason, and I'm not really sure what it is, they always lay it out as being 3 plus 1. They don't put it together. I believe because the initial one is an internal perception.
Oh, okay.
And the other three are external, and I think that they can't be categorized in the same because of that.
Yeah. Well, actually, that relates to you know, fourth way contracts, because there's, you know, the Trinity, there's a law of three, and then, you know, if you go further or closer to, you know, the origin, to the Almighty, then you have one, a singularity, whether that's, you know, the one becomes three or the three becomes one or however you want to do it. So I don't know if they've thought of that, but that's what strikes me just now.
Well, I am certain because I believe that all things are connected and all things are fluid and I completely believe that your suspicion, your thought, is probably more dead on the money than we'll give credit for today here on this ooze. So,
yeah.
You know.
Also, I was thinking that, of course, we already know, you know, the great ultimate answer to the life, the universe, and everything, which is, of course, 42. And it's only the question that we lack. Are you aware of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy?
I am, and actually that existed long before The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Really?
Yeah, when I was a child, I can remember my uncle telling me that 42 is the answer, but what is the question, son? And that was, you know, I'm thinking I was maybe my son's age the first time I heard it, so you're talking not even in the 80s yet. So...
That's very strange. I don't know where he would have gotten it if it wasn't from that.
I have no idea either, but again, like I said, I can remember that. And you know what? I might call him up and ask him. This is the same man who solved the big problem I had by quoting philosophy from Mary Poppins. So,
okay.
He's a very peculiar gentleman. I was getting ready to do a major auto repair, and though I am mechanically inclined, I had never at that point rebuilt the motor. And I haven't had any training of any sort. And, I was very perplexed as to, how I was going to pull it off, because I didn't have the money to take it and get it fixed, at a mechanic, but I could afford the parts that I needed if I did the labor myself. And he said to me, well, there's this line in Mary Poppins that I love, and I'm going to share it with you because it holds the answer to what's going on. And I said, what's that? And he said, well begun is half done. That's the line from Mary Poppins that he quoted.
Mm-hmm.
Well, meaning with enough preparation, if I had all the right tools and I had all the schematics and everything, that I would find at the end of it that it was easy to do the job.
Yeah.
And, but anyway, that's, what's that?
I said that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. But he always does strange things like that. I've heard philosophy from Mary Poppins, from Shrek. Just from a lot of obscure places, so.
Yeah, it's almost like a kind of folklore bit of wisdom that's, passed down and.
Yeah, well, you have to understand, he spent the entire 70s under the influence of at least LSD, if not 15 or 20 other drugs at one time.
Yeah.
And he was the textbook definition of a hippie. He was into meditation. He was into, the earthy shit. He was, he was into the string theory and shit that they were all, just getting into scientifically. And so he used to sit between these two big speakers in his house with the volume turned all the way up and try to, manifest something or. So I have to ask him where he got that from.
Well, I'm going to go on a hunch and say that he got it from the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. I just tried to do a little Google search, and it keeps going back to Douglas Adams as like the origin. Like this website, AssociatedContent.com, 42. That number, in case you didn't know, is the answer to the ultimate question of life, the universe, and everything. Douglas Adams's increasingly mislabeled Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy trilogy introduced us to the supercomputer Deep Thought that provided the answer of 42 to the ultimate question. One must wonder what kind of research Douglas Adams did to arrive at this particular number, since it seemed to have a profound mystical omnipresence almost on par with the number 3 or 7. One can expect with great certainty that the appearance of 42 in pop culture has its origins in Douglas Adams' universe. There are other instances of 42 that lead one to suspect Adams did not just pluck 42 out of thin air as the ultimate answer to the question of life, the universe, and everything. And then it just gives some examples, like 42 degrees is the angle in which light must reflect off water in order to create a rainbow, and, in the genealogy found in the Gospel of Matthew, 42 generations extend from Abraham to Jesus Christ, blah, blah, all that stuff. So I have a feeling he got it from that. I was choked on the nut. I don't know when that was written, but I can look it up.
Yeah, I'm looking myself. Wow, this is way off of Isaac Newton.
Yeah.
But
originally a radio comedy broadcast on BBC Radio 4 in 1978. It was later adapted to other formats, and over several years it gradually became an international multimedia phenomenon. Adaptations have included stage shows, a series of 5 books, first published between 1979 and 1992, blah, blah, blah. So, yeah, maybe he read the book in, 1979, and that's where he picked it up from.
So that could well be. Could very well be. I mean,
if he comes back with a different answer, I definitely want to know where he got it from, because that's kind of a weird coincidence, and maybe there's something that we don't know.
That's
so, yeah, definitely ask him. Definitely ask him where he got that from.
I will. But it's very possible. Like I said, the man watched Mary Poppins, so it's very possible that he read that, because he was very big into all that type of stuff. Anything that could be derivative of fantasy, and there was philosophy within it, that was his deal.
Yeah,
I'm actually
probably a big fan of like Robert Anton Wilson as well.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. So let's see.
I think his the number 23. And of course, then you get the whole.
Wait a minute. You know what?
What was?
I'm looking on Wiki at the actual number 42. It says here, under the religion section, it says 42 is the number with which God creates the universe in Kabbalistic tradition. In Kabbalah, it is the most significant name is that of En Sof, also known as Ein Sof, or infinite or endless. The 42-lettered name contains four combined names, which are all spelled in Hebrew. So, he may have gotten it from some of the philosophical stuff that he was reading back then.
Yeah, that could.
Oh, wait a minute. Then there's also, it could just be from Lewis Carroll, too, also, because I guess Lewis Carroll used it in Alice in Wonderland.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, though. There's just a whole bunch of stuff. I'm going to ask him directly. It could be as early as 1966. Mathematician Paul Cooper theorized that the fastest, most efficient way to travel across continents would be to bore a hollow tube. The time for such a journey works out to be 42 minutes. I don't know. It's just a number that's apparently extremely significant. And I will find out where he got it from.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll go from there.
Yeah. That's wow. That's a pretty good find, the whole 42 is the number with which God creates the universe in Kabbalistic tradition. That's very interesting.
That is extremely interesting.
Yeah. Hmm.
Anyway, in something we can actually more grasp, in my research of Newton, I just found it extremely comical in one way or the other. And I haven't honestly read enough of Newton's work to speculate myself, but I saw videos where there was this claim that Newton was this devout Christian, and he was totally like hooked on Jesus and all that stuff. And then a little bit later, I think it was the next video or maybe the video after that, the guy was claiming that he was Luciferian and that, in fact, he was a Satanist. And that he had proof as well. So I don't know. I guess that's something we'll have to, just kind of spectate on. I mean, it's the same with Lovecraft. There are a lot of people who argue that he's an atheist, and other people who suspect that he, was tied to the occult himself. And to further make that fascinating, a concept occurred to me. I mean, I guess it wasn't anything new, but it was something while I was studying this on YouTube. One of the people I'm subscribed to, as you know, is Jason King. I happened to click on one of Jason King's videos on accident when I was going through the stuff that was recommended for me, because what I usually do is I'll I'll start by searching, you know, keywords that I know associate with the person that I'm trying to study. And then Google does its little math, and then a video will pop up that'll have an extra little factor that I didn't know or wasn't made aware of in my studies prior to that. You know, at the bottom, it's that little recommended for you section where they take everything that you're looking at in general and put up videos that match, you know. But clicking on this, I read this thing on Jason King's page where I'd never given it the credit that it deserved prior to that, and that Jason King doesn't look at things in terms of entity, but rather in field. So he doesn't consider himself to be theist or atheist, because to him, it's all more of an energy-based thing. So perhaps, you know, the same could be said for Newton or Lovecraft, you know, rather they had a different perspective, and that's why what they believed and what they thought was so ambiguous.
Or yeah, I definitely think an outsider's perspective is very important, and it really puts a different spin on things. And I think that's more important than having a genius IQ or writing 20 books or whatever. Being able to look at things in a different way, very important.
Absolutely, and I think that's actually probably the most resounding theme in all the people that we've taken a look at, is they've all been able to look at something in a completely different way.
Yeah, definitely.
So, in that,
go ahead.
In that, I just believe that, if we always... first examine what's inside the box and how it's, you know, pretty packaged, and then we step out and we look at the box and how it's pretty packaged, and then if we crush the box and throw it away and look to see what's left over, we may have a better understanding of what was in the box to begin with.
Yes.
Yeah. So...
Yeah, better to take a look at the box from different angles.
Right. Beyond just different angles, I mean, one of the things that I think is limited in science is that there is a set of methods in how to examine something. Well, if you step outside of those methods, it's no longer scientific method, and it can lose its validity in other people's eyes. On the other hand, it could also lead to a discovery that's completely and totally new or different. I mean, that's really pretty much what happened. If you take gravity and you take electromagnetism, and they were predominant up until the mid 20th century. They were predominantly the only fields or forces that science knew and understood, or at least thought they knew and understood. And then here comes quantum mechanics with a completely and totally different method. And instead of, if you have this and this happens, this is going to be the result. Now you've got quantum mechanics, quantum physics telling us that if you do this, if you have this and you do this, you have, a percentage of a possibility that it's going to be this, but there are these infinite other things that it can do.
Right. Well, each different method is a different angle.
Right. But it's angles in terms of thought rather than visual,
right.
linear visual examination.
Right. Exactly.
So, I don't know. You never know. The world's greatest monopoly player may one day unravel the secret to, quantum physics.
Yeah, maybe. That definitely could be.
Yeah.
I did find a little bit more on the whole Kabbalah 42 thing.
Okay.
So in Kabbalah, the name Eloka is generally associated with the Sephirah of Chesed, as is the name Kel, which is composed of the first two letters of Eloka. Eloka, as well as Kel, is often considered to represent a meta-name, i.e., a reference for God's very unnameable essence, which possesses a spectrum of names or garbs. The soul of Israel is described as an actual part of Eloka from on high. Eloka equals 42, 2 times 21, the value of God's name, Ekyeh, which appears as a pair in God's words to Moses, Ekyeh, Asher, Ekyeh. As the world was created with the power of God's 42-letter name, the name Eloka implies the power of creation. The name Kel in Atbash equals 420 equals 10 times Eloka. One of the secrets of 42 in Kabbalah in relation to the creation of the universe is that the divine act of creation begins with God saying, Yehi, let there be, equals 25, and concludes with God seeing his creation to be Tav, good, equals 17.25. The beginning of the creation process plus 17, the conclusion of the creative process, equals 42, the all-inclusive power of creation. It goes on, but I'm not going to bore everyone with that.
Yeah, well, I think that that's something that you have to spend some time, you know, even really studying to comprehend.
Yeah,
so
fully grasp the underpinnings of that. Yeah,
and certainly. So, with all that in mind, we are now well within our undiluted truth segment, and to be honest with you, my brain's beat up. So let's just do our thing and get us out of here, you know?
Sure. What would our thing be?
Our thing would be just bullshitting.
Oh, okay. Well, we kind of already went off topic, so I thought that was, we were already into the undiluted truth. But I guess not.
Yeah. Well, in some aspects, but if
in
you...
In some aspects. But yeah. In other aspects, I guess we could retain the spirit of the topic. Speaking of topics, the next show on March 6th is creative writing and short fiction. So
right. That
should be good. That's something where we don't actually have to research that much. We just have to bring our own spin or our own take on what that is, you know, on our own creative process and our own fiction writing ability.
Sure. Now, do you actually want to... next week, do you actually want to examine one particular story, or do we want to?
I wasn't going to. You could if you want. I was basically going to talk about my own thoughts on writing and my own process on, creative short fiction.
Okay, all right. That gives me a little bit of a better understanding of what we're aiming for this next week. So.
Well, we could take it from different angles, certainly. I mean, you can do anything regarding that. And maybe during the show we'll get off on topic. We'll, the show will become something different, but somehow related to that.
Okay. Well, we'll call that what it is, man, and just move forward as we always do. I got to say, this tsunami thing, I didn't know anything about it, and I haven't had a chance to really look into it, but I'm looking at shit that's kind of epic in proportioning here. Not very long ago, we had that huge earthquake in Haiti, and now they're talking about Hawaii getting smacked the fuck down.
Yeah.
There's definitely some shit going on. With that in mind, I've heard people, call global warming bullshit, and other people call it, catalyst as far as what's actually going on. So I'm curious as to what your take is. Do you think that all of this odd weather phenomenon is part of some massive apocalyptic doomsday that's pending over our head, or is it just maybe part of a bigger cycle?
I think it's just nature. I was hanging out with my old high school friends just a couple nights ago, and one of them was sarcastically saying, he was kind of mocking like the religious right and a lot of conservatives, and saying that, you know, God just hates black people and gays and stuff like that, and that's why God is punishing everybody that lives in New Orleans or San Francisco or Hawaii and things like that. But obviously that's not true. It's just funny that a lot of people believe that. No, I don't think it's anything that conscious or deliberate. I think it's just, you know, shit happens because, you know, this is a universe full of suffering. And, it, you know, there's always going to be something. There's always going to be tragedy and shit coming down. There's always going to be crap we have to deal with. It's obnoxious, but just got to roll with it, I guess.
One of the spins that I've seen around the internet, and I can't remember exactly where I saw this, but one of the theories was that the Illuminati, the people, the secret magic occult group that's hiding in the corner plotting out the destruction of the world, is in fact cause of the natural phenomenon that's been happening lately. And not in the fact that they, like, you know, said, oh, we're going to send a tsunami to Hawaii and an earthquake in Haiti, but rather when you force the universe to do something, you know, that's outside of its original intended timeline, you create a shift in stability in another segment of that network. And so that's why all this stuff is happening. It's actually repercussion from people using magic carelessly rather than with thought. And I didn't know whether to even try to put any stock in that. But I thought
it was...
That's
an interesting theory. But then, of course, you know, it all happened to do with the environment as well, like in location, because... You know, that shit, aside from the occasional tornado, that stuff never happens in Wisconsin. And Wisconsin is, you know, a huge place for not only magic, but serial killers and other weird crap.
Sure.
But, you know, we're not going to get a tsunami, we're not going to get a hurricane, we're not going to get any of that weird, you know, tropical storm stuff or killer bees or whatever, just because Wisconsin is so north. In the Midwest. And it's,
right.
You
instead,
know.
You guys got the curse of the cheese hut. So.
Yeah. Yeah. That and the Packers and all the other sports dominating, you know, idiocy that goes on. The cold and the snow, we got that, which sucks ass. So we have our own, you know, suffering to deal with, but, you know, I don't know. It's an interesting theory, the whole magical repercussions and stuff. But I don't know.
I don't either. But we're almost out of time, man. So, as always, I want to thank you for making the show possible.
You're welcome.
And you got any special thank yous or anything you want to do?
Well, thank you and my friend, The New Nonsense. And the guy that wrote that essay, Half Choked Deep of Cosmic Fear, David G.L. And I'm just going to close with the number 42.
42, fuckers. See you next week. if the outro music will play.
There you go.
Thank you for listening to the Ooze. Opinions expressed by our guests or callers do not necessarily reflect those held by Venture or Beast or any institution associated with us. The Ooze does not condone any illegal or unethical acts. If you have been offended during the production of the show, we're sorry, but as the old expression goes, tough luck. Thank you, and see you next week.